This Is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, debate has been reignited in Connecticut over whether certain voter information should be accessible to anyone after the president's Voter Fraud Commission asked for all 50 states to voluntarily hand over the information. We'll hear about the concerns being raised in our state and get an update on how the Connecticut Secretary of State's office is handling the request by the president's Anti-Fraud Voter Commission. That's later. First, you've heard of Auschwitz and Dachau, both Nazi concentration camps where more than a million people died. But have you heard of Ravensbrück? Today, Where We Live, we speak with the author who wrote Lilac Girls. Her book is based on the personal stories of a group of Polish women who were imprisoned at the camp and forced to undergo medical experiments. They were nicknamed the Rabbits. Have you heard of them? Or have you read the book, Lilac Girls? Join the conversation today, 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at wmpr.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Now, this World War II story has a Connecticut connection. To tell us more, we're joined now in studio by author Martha Hall Kelly. Martha, welcome to Where We Live.
Thanks, Lucy.
I mentioned your novel, Lilac Girls. It came out last year?
Yes, in hardcover, and it just came out in paperback a couple months ago.
You live in Connecticut. You're a writer. Was this your first book?
Yes. Yes, I had never written anything before, really, except advertising. I was an advertising copywriter for many years, and then I had my third child and became a stay-at-home mom and retired.
I mentioned the Connecticut connection. That would be a woman by the name of Caroline Faraday. Take us back to the 30s and the story of this woman. People may not know her. Tell us about her.
Oh, she was incredible. I discovered her story one gray Mother's Day when I went up to the Bellamy Faraday house in Bethlehem, Connecticut. I drove up from my home. I was living in Fairfield, Connecticut at the time. And I discovered Caroline, and I couldn't get her out of my head. She was a philanthropist, a former Broadway actress, and a very wealthy woman that gave up everything to work for this this cause of bringing the rabbits to America.
She was a Francophile, a New York socialite. The summers she spent time, and you mentioned the Bellamy Faraday House. That's in Bethlehem, Connecticut. We're going to learn more about that house. It's become a Connecticut landmark later in the show. But tell us about her upbringing in Connecticut. Did she spend many of her summers here?
She did. Her father, sadly, died when she was 11, and she and her mother spent their summers up in Bethlehem working on their garden, and they collected specimen lilacs from all over the world. And that's why I went up to the house to see the lilacs. And it was not disappointing. But I came for the lilacs, but I came away with her story. And I started going up there to work in the archives. She has three archives, one in Paris and one in Washington, D.C. at the Holocaust Museum. And the third one is at the house. So I started going up there to research her.
She's American. Why did she have such an affinity for France? I understand she volunteered at the French consulate during World War II.
She did. And she and her mother used to spend August in Paris at their apartment there. And so she had a lot of French friends. And that's how she found out about the rabbits. After the war, some of her French friends that had been incarcerated at Ravensbrück knew these Polish Catholic women that had been operated on, and they told Caroline about them and how they were suffering behind the Iron Curtain. And Caroline reached out to them, and it was not an easy task, but she ended up bringing them to the United States for rehabilitation and a fabulous trip across the country.
What did you know about Ravensbrück concentration camp? This was outside Berlin. Again, I mentioned in the intro, we hear about Auschwitz and Dachau, but Ravensbrück was primarily for women.
It was. It was the only female camp in the Third Reich, and the only major one. And I didn't know anything about it either until I started researching in Caroline's archives. And then I was just fascinated. She had done a lot of research, especially on the only female doctor at the camp, Hertha Oberhauser. And so I became interested in her by researching in Caroline's archives.
These were women that were imprisoned. What did they do?
They were Girl Scouts, sadly, back in Lublin, Poland. And they had joined the underground in Lublin. And the youngest was 14. And they did it for social reasons because their friends were doing it. They didn't realize that it was so dangerous. And So they were arrested and sent to Ravensbrück. They were Polish Catholic women, all of them. And so I, in researching them, went to Lublin and then took the same train route that the women were forced to take when they were arrested, from Warsaw to Berlin, and then from Berlin up to Fürstenberg to visit Ravensbrück. Because I felt I couldn't write about the story without actually seeing it.
In your book, you focus on a particular woman who was imprisoned at Ravensbrück, Kasia. Tell us about how you formulated this character based on the research you did. And then you also mentioned this doctor who worked for the Third Reich, Herta.
I based Kasia. There are three characters. There's Caroline, and then Herta Oberhauser, who's the doctor at the camp that helped perform the experiments, and then Kasia Kuzmarek is a composite character of all the different rabbits. There are 72 of them, and but she's also based mainly on Nina Avanska, a real prisoner who wrote some secret letters that I found out about. I can't say too much about it because it's a spoiler for the book, but I loved the story of Nina Avanska and her sister Christina, who was a doctor when she went in, when she was arrested as well. So I thought it was fascinating that a doctor would be operated on and how she would see that situation. But it was fascinating to write from all three different points of view.
Why did you decide to tell the story in this way, based on a true story but written as fiction?
You know, it just kind of happened. I had never written a novel before. I met a book editor one day and told her the story, and she said, "This is a novel. You should write it. All I need is a chapter." And I moved to Atlanta and had no friends. And it all just kind of came out one day when I had a Starbucks caffeinated latte by mistake. It all just came out. So I didn't really think about it that much. I'm embarrassed to say. It all just kind of came out.
This is Where We Live. In studio with me is as author of Lilac Girls, Martha Hall Kelly. She lives in Connecticut. She wrote this book last year, but it's based on a socialite who lived in Connecticut, Caroline Faraday, and how she helped many women, I think about 35 of them. We'll learn more about that journey they took to the U.S. They were experimented on by the Nazis during World War II at the Ravensbrück concentration camp. We mentioned that they were nicknamed the Rabbits, but tell us specifically what kind of experiments that they went through.
They were chosen by Himmler to have experiments done to their legs. They were opened up surgically, and glass and bacterial cultures and dirt were put into their wounds, and they were sewn back up to test the efficacy of sulfa drugs. A lieutenant of Hitler's had been killed and died from gas gangrene, and the doctors at the camp were trying to prove to Hitler that the treatment that this lieutenant received, because he didn't get sulfa drugs, was the correct treatment. So they used these women as their laboratory animals.
So their legs were opened up. Sometimes their bones were removed.
Yes, yes. It's just so horrible. A lot of them died from the experiments, because from tetanus and gas gangrene, but the ones that survived hopped around the camp because their legs had been so terribly mistreated, and that's why the Nazis nicknamed them the Rabbits.
We're going to learn more about how some of them survived coming up with a documentarian who's working on a film about the women at Ravensbrück. But I wanted to learn more about, so Caroline worked again at the French consulate during the war. She heard about the Rabbits, and how did she get people to be behind this cause of helping these women?
Well, she had heard that Norman Cousins, who was the editor of the Saturday Review, she had heard that he had helped a group of women come to this country called the Hiroshima Maidens, who were women suffering after the atom bomb. And she went to Norman Cousins at the Saturday Review and said, you need to help me with this, bringing these Polish Catholic women here from Lublin. They're suffering and they need medical attention. And he didn't believe her at first. She left, and a very determined woman, Caroline. She came back the next day with photographs that her French friends had sent her. of the women's legs, which are just horrific. And he believed her when he saw that, and he got behind it full bore. And both he and Caroline went to Warsaw and made sure that, you know, they cut through the red tape and made sure they could come to the United States. They brought doctors with them to make sure the women were healthy enough for the journey. And yeah, he became her partner, which is just wonderful. He wrote many wonderful articles in the Saturday Review about it.
But it didn't stop there. Besides just getting these some of these women here for medical treatment, she also worked to try to get reparations for these women from the German government?
Yes.
How difficult was that at the time?
Really difficult, because Germany didn't recognize Poland as a country because it was under Soviet Russia. So she worked with a lawyer named Ben Ferenc and eventually did get them reparations, which I think was one of the happiest moments of her life, because she had spent so much time with these women, and they had come to be like daughters to her. I mean, they called her their godmother, but they really were like daughters to her.
It's a really fascinating story. Again, I mentioned you live in Connecticut, Martha. Do you think a lot of people know about Caroline Faraday and her role in helping these women?
You know, it's funny.
Even after your book came out.
It's so funny. Even people that lived in Bethlehem didn't know that this had happened. And Caroline was a very modest person. She did so many wonderful things, but she didn't like to shine the light on herself. So I guess it's understandable, but it's funny how so many people, they tell me they drove by the house every day. It's now a museum, a beautiful museum, and they never even knew the story.
I read the book, and at times it is hard to get through the way that you, again, based on the research you did, describing the conditions of the camp, what the women went through. How did this impact you?
Oh, goodness. Well, just researching Caroline made me think so much more about giving back. And it sounds kind of cliche, but it really, it's changed me in that way. I look now for things to do to give back. But it's also, being a writer now has changed me so much and in such a good way. I can't imagine what would have happened if I hadn't gone up to the house that day, because it's being a writer is so much a part of my life now.
You traveled to Germany. You visited Ravensbrück. What was that experience like?
Well, I brought my son with me, and I think I underestimated how hard it was for him. At one point, we were walking through the prison bunker, which is a really difficult place to be. It's cell upon cell, and he said, "Mom, I need to go out and sit down." And that's when I realized that I had kind of pushed it a little bit, but it was it's an incredible place. And the crematoria are still there right next to the lake, so they could toss the ashes into the lake. The shooting wall is still there that the women were so terrified of. And now people come, and since there are no graves for the women that died there, they toss red roses into the lake, and they float out into the lake, and it's such a beautiful but sad tribute.
Why do you think people haven't heard of Ravensbrück concentration camp?
You know, it was a smaller camp, and it was in Germany. A lot of the camps that were located in Poland, extermination camps, have been written about extensively. Maybe it's because it was all women. I don't know. Hmm.
We talked a lot about learning about some of the women that were experimented on, these Polish women. But Herta was a female doctor who was a real person that worked at Ravensbrück, that performed these experiments on these women. You chose to write a little bit about her. What did you learn about her that surprised you?
Oh, everything. Well, I learned about her from Caroline's archive. So I thought it was fascinating that Caroline was interested in Herta. And once I dug into it, I just couldn't believe that a woman would do that to other women, never mind a doctor. But everything about her fascinated me. I thought that, she was kind to some of the patients, it's hard to call them patients, but most of them she mistreated horribly. They were not given proper medical attention after the experiments, and some of them were operated on the rabbits two and three times. So they suffered horribly, and she really didn't give them much care.
Did you have any sympathy for Dr. Herta at any point when you learned a little bit about her life? And again, she was trained to be a doctor. The role, even though she was a doctor, how the Nazis, how they viewed women and their role at home. Did you have any sympathy for her as you learned about her?
Well, when I first wrote the book, and I got an agent, she told me, go back and rewrite Herta. Because I had made her kind of stereotyped and a bit of a cliche, and I spent a year studying National Socialism and really getting to the root of that, the BDM, which was the equivalent for women of the Hitler Youth, and how it was to be indoctrinated into the Nazi culture. And then I did get much more, I don't know if I'd call it sympathy, but understanding of how a person can go down that path, such a horrible path, because I don't think she started out as a horrible person, and she just ended up in a really terrible place.
You also added a love interest in the novel for Caroline Faraday, again, the socialite who lived in Connecticut. Why did you choose to do that?
I resisted that at first, but then I spoke to a close friend of Caroline's, and she told me about a relationship that Caroline had, a long-distance relationship, and that's when I thought, you know what, I can go ahead and add a love interest now that I knew that she had that relationship. And of course, I made him, you know, incredibly attractive. Caroline deserved it, but because I had never seen a photograph of that person. But once I knew she had a relationship, I felt like I had permission to do that.
What's the response been to your book?
Oh, my goodness. It's just been incredible. I still am pinching myself. It's every day I get emails from people thanking me. And it's been on the bestseller list now, the paperback, for, I think, 18 weeks. Or I've lost count now. But it's really, really wonderful. And I'm just so happy because so long I worked on the book thinking, well, no one will care about this story. This is just me that's so obsessed with it. And it's just so validating to have people love it, too.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. In studio with me is Martha Hall Kelly, author of Lilac Girls. It's a book about socialite Caroline Faraday. She was a Connecticut resident who helped a group of Polish women tortured by the Nazis. Now, coming up, we're going to learn more about the research that Martha did into her book and also talk with an Atlanta filmmaker about her upcoming documentary, Saving the Rabbits of Ravensbrook. Did you know about the Faraday family in Connecticut and their connection to the story? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're learning about the Connecticut connection to the story of some women held at Ravensbrück concentration camp during World War II. They were a group of more than 70 Polish women who underwent medical experiments, nicknamed the Rabbits. It was a socialite, a Connecticut resident by the name of Caroline Faraday, who worked to bring 35 of the survivors to the U.S. and brought attention to their story, leading the German government to pay reparations to them for what the Nazis did. Their stories were the basis for a book released last year called Lilac Girls. I've been speaking with author Martha Hall Kelly, who's in the studio with me, also a Connecticut resident. And joining the conversation now is Stacey Fitzgerald. She's a producer and director of an upcoming documentary called Saving the Rabbits of Ravensbrook. Stacey, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell us about your connection to this story. When did you first hear about it?
I first heard about it. It's probably been, Martha, what do you think, 5 years ago, maybe, when we first met. And we actually met through our husbands, and we were at dinner, and we were talking, and I found out about Martha working on this novel. And when she told me the story about Caroline, about the rabbits, and about the amazing rescue that happened in the camp, I was, I really couldn't get it out of my mind. I kept thinking about it and thinking about it. And also, I had a family connection. My great uncle had helped liberate a woman's concentration camp and had told me about that in the past and asked that I speak up about what he had seen with his own two eyes. And so I think the interest was there, and then I was really blown away by the story of that, again, not only the rabbits and Caroline Faraday's role, but how the women in the camp themselves rallied around this this group of injured women to save their lives.
I asked Martha earlier why she thinks many people don't know about Ravensbrück concentration camp and about the story of these women nicknamed the Rabbits. Why do you think that is?
You know, I know maybe part of it was the fact that it was Ravensbrück fell in what became East Germany. And so access wasn't necessarily as, I guess, easy for folks to get to study. I think Martha also brings up a good point that, you know, people were studying other camps. And I'm not sure that there was necessarily the interest before to study a woman's concentration camp. As she said, it was a smaller camp, and it was all women. And I think that was probably part of it as well.
Tell us about the research then that that you undertook. You mentioned that this documentary is not just about the women, the Rabbits, but the other women who worked to save them. Tell us about them.
Yes, I thought, you know, you'd imagine the conditions of a concentration camp. And when this rescue took place, it was, you know, February 1945, so right at the end of the war. And you'd think, finally, these women who were starving to death and sick would think, wow, finally light at the end of the tunnel. And yet the fact that they risked their lives or shared their bread with these young girls to save their life right there at the end, I was really struck by that. And so I did search for, I read all the accounts that I could of anybody who had been part of the rescue, the women themselves who were saved. But I did find one of the women in the French Resistance who was a very close friend of Nina Ivanska, one of the Polish women that Martha mentioned earlier. And she was part of the rescue herself, and I was able to go to Paris and interview her and ask her, you know, why she and so many others, and was that true? Was it everybody in the camp? You know, it was 20 different nations. Women were in there for all sorts of reasons, so maybe primarily most of them were political prisoners, meaning they were in some form of resistance against the Nazi regime, but they were criminals. There were people there because they were Jewish. There were all these different reasons. So how do you get all these women from different religions, different countries, different political beliefs to come together? And, you know, she explained, she said, yeah, they were struck by it. I mean, she, for herself, she was almost offended, like, what other choice would I have had? Of course I would have risked my life to save them. And she was with them there that final night as they thought they were going to be executed and as they were preparing to be executed. And then as this idea started to form, hey, why don't give in. You need to fight. We need to continue to resist. Let's try to figure out a way to hide you. And convince, a lot of the Rabbits had to be convinced, you know, that they should try to hide and try to live.
Stacey, you interviewed some of the surviving Rabbits. I just wanted to play a quick clip from your documentary, Saving the Rabbits of Ravensbrück. Here is a woman named Stasia.
Bardzo wartościowy człowiek, narwany troszeczkę, jak każdy wartościowy człowiek.
So she's speaking in Polish. Can you tell us what she's saying about Caroline Faraday? That was the question to her about this woman that worked to save them.
Yes, she said Caroline Faraday was a friend of hers. She became a friend. And that Caroline Faraday was a good person. And then she mentioned, she said she was impatient, but a good person. And, you know, I also have the benefit for everything else she described before, but she kind of sums it up at the end when she said she wanted to change the world in a day. And that was the source of her impatience. I think that all the women, when they talk about Caroline Faraday, because I also asked another of the survivors about Caroline, and she talked about, again, just what a great person that she was, and that she sought to get nothing out of it for herself. It was not about recognition. It was only about helping people, and that was the satisfaction that she got.
I understand Stacia passed away just a few weeks after you interviewed her. How many women, these so-called rabbits, are still alive today?
Two of the rabbits.
And
are now survived.
And how did you get them to open up to you, considering the trauma, the language barrier?
You know, I think the reason they agreed to do the interview in the first place is because they do believe it was their duty to bear witness. That was one of the promises that they made to each other in the camp, that they would bear witness. But that being said, it still was difficult because I think they were still traumatized from the experience. So they would, you know, start talking about it and tell us their story. But then once you started to ask them more specifics, it was hard for them. But they were very courageous. They found they might have to deflect a little bit, maybe back off, tell you to give them a moment. But then they powered through. And I do believe they felt it was important for us today to hear what they had been through and to hear how they had overcome those circumstances.
I'm speaking with Stacia Fitzgerald. She's a producer and director of an upcoming documentary called Saving the Rabbits of Ravensbrook. Caroline Faraday, a New York socialite who lived in Connecticut, Bethlehem, Connecticut, helped bring 35 of these women to the U.S. for medical treatment. Stacy, when you spoke with these two or three women that were still alive at the time when you were in Europe doing research and filming, did they hold on to resentment for what the Nazis did to them?
No. I think that was one of the surprising things that Martha and I both found. Martha, I went over twice, and Martha came with me my first trip and to meet these women and to talk to them. But amazingly, no. And I know that Stacia spoke to that directly, and she talked about something they learned in the camp, and that was that you really only knew in the camp you probably had 5 minutes. I mean, that's the only thing you could count on was the next 5 minutes. And then your life could change forever. And she said, so why waste any of that 5 minutes with bitterness or anger or resentment? She said they tried to fill it with joy, with friendship, with things that made that time valuable. And she also made the point that she goes, I know you think that this is going to sound crazy, but we tried to find things to laugh about, even in that horrific place, even no matter what we were going through. We tried to find things that made us laugh. And believe it or not, we did, and that helped us get through. And I think they brought that attitude, and she talked about that after the camp. There's just no time for anger and resentment.
Martha Hall Kelly is in studio with us. She's the author of Lilac Girls. She was working with Stacia on this documentary. Martha, what was it like to talk as well to some of these surviving women that were tortured during World War II and to see years later how they've persevered and have been resilient?
Oh, it was incredible. I mean, that was my number one wish in life, was to just meet them. And so when Stacy and I went back over for my second trip and we had a chance to talk to them, oh, it was just incredible. And the way they were received at the camp was beautiful. Don't you think, Stacy?
Oh, yeah.
It was so nice to see young people just like swamping them. Stacia was in a wheelchair, and young people were coming up to her and taking selfies and hugging and kissing her, and it was just such a beautiful thing, especially because she was that age when she was operated on at the camp. So it was wonderful to see it come full circle.
And Stacia Fitzgerald, again, producer and director of Saving the Rabbits of Ravensbrook. I want to play one more clip from your upcoming documentary. This was a gentleman by the name of Benjamin Ferenz. He's talking about Caroline Faraday, again, this Connecticut resident who worked to bring some of these Polish women to the U.S. He's talking about when Caroline first approached him to try and get reparations from the German government for these women.
She said, well, I have been with a group of women who were in the concentration camp in Ravensbrück. You managed to negotiate with the Germans about paying compensation to all of the victims of Nazi persecution. They were clearly victims of persecution because they were subjected to all kinds of horrible medical experiments, but they were excluded. And they wanted to know how could they get compensation. They were all poor girls now living in Poland who had been stripped of everything. Well, I said, your information you have about their legal claim is correct. There is no provision in the German law to cover cases of people with whom Germany had no diplomatic relations, which meant simply we were not going to send money into communist territory. At that time, Senator MacArthur was screaming that everybody was a communist. That was a mission impossible on his face. Well, I like missions impossible if they were right.
And so Benjamin Ferencz was one of the prosecutors that helped get these reparations eventually to these Polish women, Stacey?
Yes. Carolyn Faraday, he said in another part of that conversation that people had said, you know, he's the one you need to go talk to. And he, she talked to him about it. He took on the case, and not just he did have all of the connections with the German government, and he knew who to talk to, and I think he understood how to try to apply pressure. But he was also part of that pressure was a PR campaign that Norman Cousins then helped carry out. So the women came over for the medical treatments, but then they were able to take them around the country, and they took them to cities that might have had a lot of people of Polish background, and they were able to, as newspapers picked up this story and talked about these women, what they'd been through, and what the West German government wasn't taking any responsibility for it at all, it then put pressure on those congressmen that then had them send a letter to the diplomats, the West German diplomats here in this country, and it worked. They finally realized that it wasn't a financial matter, that this was a political issue, and it was doing horrific things to the reputation of the new West German government, and they needed to recognize what they had done to the women and pay them reparations.
Stacey, quickly, when will your documentary be released?
Hopefully next year. We've got the bulk of the filming done. We have some a couple of follow-up interviews to do and some subject matter experts, and then we just work on finishing it and hopefully have it out next year.
We've been talking about the role of a woman who lived in Connecticut, Caroline Faraday, in helping these Polish women, again, who were experimented on by the Nazis during World War II. Caroline Faraday's family home is now open to the public. I wanted to bring to the conversation Cheryl Hack, Executive Director of Connecticut Landmarks. Cheryl, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you so much, Lucy.
We've been remarking about not many people know about Caroline Faraday. Tell us about where her home is in Connecticut. I understand Bethlehem, Connecticut. And what will people learn when they visit this home?
Her home is right across from the Green in Bethlehem, Connecticut, where the Reverend Bellamy built it in 1754. And the Faraday family arrived in Bethlehem, and Martha had mentioned earlier, I think, to find a summer place to get out of the heat in New York. In 1912, they purchased the property, and they really developed beautiful gardens, as well as making some colonial revival changes to the house to accommodate their needs.
Since Martha Hall Kelly's book has come out, again, Lilac Girls, have you seen interest in the Bellamy Faraday home grow, Cheryl?
Oh, my goodness. You know, people are so interested in stories and so interested in heroism. And as I think Stacey and Martha have so beautifully shared with listeners today, my goodness, Caroline was a social justice rock star. So we have seen many, many people coming to the property to learn more about her and to really enjoy the beautiful gardens and very peaceful setting that she created.
We were remarking in the newsroom, Cheryl, many people may not know about the Ravensbrück rabbits. When someone visits this house, how are they told about this story?
So there's the opportunity to view the house really through Caroline's eyes. So Caroline was very interested in Reverend Bellamy. He and acquired many of his family artifacts. So there's that piece in the house. But there are also many, many very special items of hers, like where she prayed, her Russian icons, the images of the Ravensbrück women who came back to and were brought to the property. So, you know, we're really looking to present Caroline from the point of view of her broader work and her broader life that led up to this work.
I understand Martha, again, she's the author of Lilac Girls. You're going to be giving a talk this weekend at the house. Tell us about that.
Yes, I can't wait. This is the second event. We had one in June that sold out, so we're doing another one. And it's house tours, which is so wonderful. And I will be in Caroline's Playhouse signing books, like I did last time, which was so much fun to meet the readers. And then I'm just going to talk a little bit about the story and how I came to write it afterwards. And I think we're also showing Stacy's trailer, which is always a big hit.
Well, I want to thank Cheryl Hack. She's the executive director of Connecticut Landmarks. The event that Martha was talking about, you can go to our website, WNPR.org/where we live. We'll also tweet out information, and registration is required, I believe, for that event. So, Cheryl, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. WWWCTLandmarks.org has all the ticket purchase information for Saturday.
Thank you. And then also Stacey Fitzgerald, a producer and director of Saving the Rabbits of Ravensbrück. Stacey, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
And I'll quickly go back to author Martha Hall Kelly in studio with me, again, author of Lilac Girls. What are you working on next?
I have two prequels that Random House just acquired, and they go back in time to tell the pre-story behind Lilac Girls. And the first one is called Gin Lane, and it features Caroline's mother, Eliza Faraday, and her help to help the White Russians. I just got back from Russia a few months ago researching there, and I think it's a fascinating story. And then the third book, the second prequel, takes place in the Civil War, and it is based on the life of Caroline's great-grandmother, Eliza Jane Wolseley, who was a nurse on the Gettysburg battlefield.
So we'll look for both of those prequels coming up. Again, Martha Hall Kelly, author of Lilac Girls. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Lucy.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Now, coming up, we're going to shift a little. Do you know how much of your personal information is online? Efforts by the Trump administration to seek personal voter information to investigate fraud has raised questions about how much voter information is available in Connecticut. Greg Gladke from the Hartford Courant will tell us more after the break. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. The Hartford Courant reported recently that some Connecticut lawmakers and election officials will renew efforts to restrict public release of some of the personal information on voters. Why now? Joining us is Greg Gladke, reporter for the Hartford Courant. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be with you.
So tell us first, if we're registered voters, how much of our information is available out there?
Almost everything that you put on the when you register to vote, it is public information right now. Your home address, your party affiliation, in some cases, if you supplied your telephone number, that's also there. It will show you how often you have voted in recent elections. They can't say who you voted for, but they can say, so Joe Smith voted in the 2016 election. He voted in the one before that. So it's for politicians, it's very valuable. For a lot of voters, it's a big surprise to find out that you can go on the internet right now and get all this information.
Your birth date as well?
Your birth date as well. That's one of the big issues right now for lawmakers and public officials because they worry that as one ACLU official said it could be a identity theft kit. If you can get somebody's address and their date of birth, you can do a lot of damage.
Give us an idea of, maybe listeners will be freaking out when they hear this, what kind of websites can they go to get this information?
There's a website that has been put up by a gentleman in New Hampshire. He calls it a genealogical website, but his argument is that this is free public information. It should be free to everybody. There are political websites that will charge you a fee to get all kinds of information. They use your date of birth, your address, your voting record, your party affiliation to profile voters so that candidates can go and target them for information, for phone calls, things like that. So you can also file a Freedom of Information request with the state and get this this kind of information on people. And the idea is that you want to prevent voter fraud, that the government can look at a date of birth and make sure that Joe Smith from Bridgeport isn't the same Joe Smith who voted in Hartford. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea behind it. But there are some restrictions in Connecticut, but very few. Law enforcement officers can have their home addresses removed. Certain types of crime victims, sexual assault victims, people who are victims of stalkers can also apply to have their addresses kept secret. But there are other much broader restrictions in other states, and some of those lawmakers here would like to copy, I think.
If an individual wanted to get their information off some of those websites you mentioned, can they just contact them and get them off, or no?
They can. The New Hampshire website, they have a process for getting your name and your confidential information off the website. But it's involved, and it you can't do it online. You have to send a letter, a certified letter, so that somebody else isn't withdrawing your information from that website. As for far as the political websites, I'm not so sure. I did not contact them, so presumably you could ask them to keep it confidential.
And this has been brought up before, but why now? Related to this Trump Commission?
Yes. The request by the Kobach Commission, Trump's anti-voter fraud commission, has stirred up a lot of anxiety among voters. Connecticut Secretary of the State Denise Merrill, the top election official here, said she's gotten hundreds of emails from voters saying, don't send my information to the Trump administration. Critics of Trump and his people, like Chris Kobach, the chairman of this co-chairman of this commission, say that they're looking to suppress voter turnout, particularly for minorities. They deny that. They say this is only looking at voter fraud. But there is nothing to back up so far in anywhere in the U.S. The Trump administration's claims that millions of people have been voting illegally in the U.S.
Now, we reached out to Secretary of State Denise Merrill to join us, but because of a scheduling conflict, she couldn't. But walk us through again when this request came out from this commission, this anti-fraud, voter fraud commission under the Trump administration for this information. The Connecticut, what was her response? And has that been walked back a little bit?
It has been. Initially, she said she was very suspicious of the request for all this information. She wasn't going to supply and couldn't supply things like the last four digits of the people's voters' social security numbers, which was one of the things that the Kobach Commission suggested be supplied. But she also pointed out at the time that under Connecticut law, this is public information. If you file the proper request and you pay a fee, if you pay a $300 fee, you can get the entire state voter roll. Within a week, Denise Merrill walked that back, as you put it, saying she doesn't want to cooperate at all, that she hasn't had a formal request. But the truth is, according to Freedom of Information officials here in Connecticut, if they make a formal request right now under state law, she can't deny them that information.
Do we know yet if that has happened?
It hasn't happened yet. The Kobach Commission is being sued by one group. And apparently that's caused them to put a hold on their requests. At least 44 states have refused or are refusing in part to cooperate, which has prompted Trump to say, what are they hiding? The concern from a lot of these state officials, including Denise Merrill, is that this information could be used in ways that it was not intended for, that it could be used to as for political purposes or voter suppression purposes. So that's that controversy has generated a lot of concern and renewed interest in just how do we protect this voter information.
What are you hearing from lawmakers to try to strengthen this law to keep them, maybe the birth date and other information private?
Yes. May Flexer is co-chair of the legislature's General Administration Elections Committee. She would like to see birth dates redacted or kept private. Merrill has also suggested that. Other lawmakers have said, well, let's not let anybody put it up on the internet. But all these suggestions have run into problems in the past. One problem is that if you try to redact or keep secret people's information like birth dates that have already been supplied and been public in the past, it could become very confusing and costly. The state librarian said that he has 365 cubic feet of election records dating back hundreds of years. If there's a law saying he can't release dates of birth that are included in there, he's going to have a real mess on his hands and a costly, complex, difficult situation. So it's not as simple as, oh, we're just not going to give out the information.
Now, a lot of focus, again, on protecting the information of voters. The state has yet to pass a budget. I think there's a vote maybe next week. But I understand calls for allowing early voting in the state of Connecticut. Has that gone nowhere this session? Can you update us on that?
I'll be honest with you. I haven't been looking at that. When I've looked at the legislature, it's all been about budgets and money. The early voting issue keeps coming up over and over again because so many other states have approved that. I'm sure it's coming. Mm-hmm. Just because people, if you can vote early, you mm-hmm. can get more people involved. But there again, one of the issues that was brought up about dates of birth is that these early ballots or absentee ballots always require dates of birth to be put on them. Mm-hmm. And how do you separate that from public information if you're checking for voter fraud? Connecticut has had some history in the past of absentee voter fraud in places like New Haven and Bridgeport.
Because of the issues you raise, Greg, is it likely that there'll be any changes then to Connecticut law?
I think that there is this push for redacting the birth dates. Probably has some legs to it. It's just one of those deals, especially in this day of identity theft, that I think an awful lot of people are going to say, well, why do we need to do that? Can't we keep that at least secret? So I think that may sail, and not this year, but probably next year it will be brought up and have a lot of support in the legislature.
I've been speaking with Greg Ladke, reporter for the Hartford Current. We'll tweet out a link to your most recent story. Greg, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Our show is produced by Lydia Brown and Jeff Tyson. Special thanks to WMPR intern Tim Cohen. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. WMPR's executive producer is Katie Tolarski. You can learn more about our show at WMPR.org/where we live. And tomorrow, we've got an interesting one coming up. Dinosaurs at your backyard feeder? We'll find out what paleontologists have learned about the prehistoric ancestors of modern-day birds. That's tomorrow on Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. As always, thanks for listening.